Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Still tough numbers out there on American housing, on foreclosure, on home prices. And now, Washington is looking to wind down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the lending giants who drove home ownership, then collapsed with the bust into the arms of the American taxpayers. That wasn't good. But what happens to home buying and selling and investments if those two go away? This hour on Point, the future of American housing. You can join the conversation. Did you think your home was your nest egg? What about now? What do you see coming? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from San Francisco for a look at what's going on with the housing market is David Streitfeld, New York Times reporter covering residential real estate. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
You've been writing recently about the housing crash hitting cities that were once thought to be kind of immune to crash.
Right. The interminable real estate collapse is entering its probably final shakeout stage. Prices fell first and most in the bubble cities in Florida and in the Southwest, like Phoenix and Tampa, Orlando, Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Now they're falling hardest in other places where the bubble was not as great, places like Minneapolis, Portland, Oregon, Seattle. These places were affected later, and they're still in the middle of trouble.
And these are not small adjustments in prices. Give us some examples of what kind of declines those cities have been seeing.
Those cities have been seeing over the past year 3, 4, 5, even 6% declines. And the worst part is they're supposed to see, most economists forecast, another 5, 6, up to even 10% in the next 6 months.
Seattle now down about 31% from its 2007 peak, you're reporting. Minneapolis dropping more now than Miami. Atlanta faring worse than Phoenix. Seattle in a bigger decline than Las Vegas. When you talk to people in these cities, are they shocked? Did they think they were protected, immune?
They thought they were protected, and this has been going on long enough for them to get pretty depressed about it. People sometimes still these days have to move for their job or for other reasons, and they just can't do it. So they're ending up renting out their old place, and since they have no money, they have to rent out a new place instead of buying one.
Why is this happening, David? I mean, Seattle has had a relatively healthy economy in the midst of bad news all over, but Minneapolis, Atlanta, these are not the places we think about as the heartland of the crash.
No, they're not. One reason it's happening is that the largest reason is that the crash, the troubles, were just so pervasive that for the first time in decades, real estate really suffered everywhere, and it just took longer to happen in these other cities. By this point, people in places like Seattle don't really think real estate is a good bet, and so they just don't want to buy a house. That is pushing the market down for everyone.
You quote Stan Humphries at the housing site Zillow saying, you know, wow, I thought we were going to have a 12% correction and call it a day, but this thing just keeps on going. Data showing that overall, last year, American home prices were down another 5.5%. Mortgage applications at a 15-year low. I'm looking here. Number of homes in foreclosure in December rose to a record 2.2 million. This housing crash is not exactly clearing the system in a hurry. What are the prospects, David?
The prospects, the best prospect is that prices will stop falling, sales will level off, and we will muddle along for quite a while until the system clears itself. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years in most places, long enough so people will forget that housing was ever supposed to provide for their retirement, because for the next 4 or 5 years, unless you're very lucky or very smart, it won't give you a good return at all.
And what about beyond that? We're going to talk in this hour about the big push now to wind down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They've been behind an awful lot of mortgage lending. What do you hear out there in the housing world about what people see on the other side of that wind down? Could it ever be the same again? Not that it should be in that super bubble, but could it just go on forever at a much lower level than we once saw?
That's what people tend to think now, maybe because they're so depressed because it's fallen so much. But if you genuinely have to do the things that people are talking about, like come up with a 20% down payment, most people are going to have to put off buying a house for a substantial amount of time unless they get much cheaper from even where they are now. But if you don't want more price declines, I'm not sure how home building is going to recover and home selling is going to recover either, because most people just can't afford houses now.
We're going to dive into this whole picture in this hour. We're very grateful to you, David. David Streitfeld, joining us there from San Francisco. Thank you so much for your time, David.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's go back. Just remember for a minute here. This was August 2007, just about a year before the housing crash, the panic. Here was President Bush celebrating all the innovations in finance and spreading home ownership.
This market has seen tremendous innovation in recent years as new lending products make credit available to more people. For the most part, this has been a positive development. And the reason why is millions of families have taken out mortgages to buy their homes, and American home ownership is at a near all-time high.
All-time high. Yahoo. Everybody feeling great about it. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac right in the middle of that. Here we are now. Last Friday, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner talking to the Initiative on Business and Public Policy at the Brookings Institution about how the U.S. mortgage market needs to reduce its government dependency.
We need to wind down Fannie and Freddie and substantially reduce the government's footprint in the housing market. And that's a process that has to happen gradually because they are now the dominant source of housing finance. And we want to be careful that that process happen in a way that doesn't interfere with or impede the process of repair in the housing market that still has a long way to go.
A long way to go. Joining us now to look at what's coming for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and American housing is Gretchen Morgenson, Pulitzer Prize-winning finance columnist for the New York Times. Gretchen, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Sure, Tom.
What went wrong with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Wow, that's a big, huge question. Well, what went wrong was ultimately at the very tail end of the real estate mania, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac really went whole hog on lending in making these questionable or financing questionable loans, subprime, Alt-A, low-doc, no-doc loans, all of the types of loans that we've heard so much about and that really were handed out like water, really at the top of the market. So, you know, during that period, I would say 2005 through 2007, they made or financed securitized a tremendous amount of questionable loans, and now those losses are coming a cropper.
Fannie Mae, of course, the Federal National Mortgage Association, and Freddie Mac, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation. What percentage of American home lending do they back, Gretchen?
Well, at one point, you know, before the bubble, before the mania, you know, when I would say the early 2000s, they touched, fully half of the mortgage market. We had a very, at that time, robust private label market, meaning private lenders like Countrywide, IndyMac, some of the names, of course, that are no longer with us. But we did have a very, very strong private market. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were, competing in there. But right now, Tom, they are responsible for, I think, 90% of the mortgages that are made today.
Which means they are the market makers. Whatever's happening out there, as stumbling as it may be, they're making it happen. But the government wants to wind them down. What? Because they ended up not being able to sort of cover their chit here. The taxpayers had to bail them out for something like 160 or 70 billion already and still counting, Gretchen?
Correct. They really, as I explained, took huge risks with the mortgages that they were financing. And they also, Tom, had a tiny, tiny amount of capital that was required for them to cushion against losses in these mortgages. So it was a combination of many things that really pushed them over the cliff. But the fact of the matter is they took huge risks. They didn't have the capital to cover the losses that emerged from those risks, and the taxpayer had to foot that bill. So that is really, in a nutshell, what happened. And now, as Mr. Geithner says, we want to reduce the government's footprint in housing because it just put the taxpayer at too much risk.
So that is what's underway now with this push to wind them down. You remind us there will be a lot of resistance to that. We'll talk about from where and how that resistance will come. But what about the market on the other side? If you take this huge player out, will private finance underwrite an American housing market as we've known it?
Probably not. I mean, I think that what we had during the 90s, from the mid-90s on all the way up until the crisis, was a policy in this country that home ownership for everyone was a good thing, that the higher the home ownership rate, the better the country would be. And so there was a lot of policy push made to try to achieve that. And you saw it in relaxing regulations. You saw it in relaxing underwriting standards, where mortgages would be underwritten to people who could not produce a sizable down payment, who could not produce a record of their employment or their assets. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it was a push on so many fronts to promote home ownership as a greater good for the nation. And, you know, it really took us down a path that was, as we see, extremely problematic.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the future of American housing and the winding down of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Gretchen Morgenson joins us from New York, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the New York Times. And it's great to have her with us. With us also right now from Philadelphia is Susan Wachter, professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Susan Wachter, welcome back to On Point.
Hello. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Maybe we should listen to a little more of what's been coming out of Washington in recent days. This hear a little bit more first from Treasury Secretary Geithner. Here he is talking on Friday about the government role, the role that the government played in the American housing market.
I think it's absolutely the case that the U.S. government provided too much support for housing, too strong incentives for investment in housing, and we just took that too far. So absolutely, the government did too much, and what it did quite poorly.
We just took it too far. It took an awful lot of Americans along with it. And then there was a voice from the past at that same Brookings meeting, Alan Greenspan, former Federal Reserve Chairman, who's taken a lot of heat for helping build the system that brought the economy to where it ended. Here he's just kind of musing out loud about how things might look if you take the government out of the equation.
I would be very curious to get a sense of what the current housing market would look like if the government were out. I know there are several things. One, mortgage rates would clearly be higher. But the question is, how much higher? The size of the market would be smaller because of that. And is that all bad?
Susan Wachter, what do you see coming here? This seems a very strong determination to wind down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You can make the case for that. Gretchen Morgenson makes it powerfully. Look what they cost the American taxpayers. There will be pushback, but if they are wound down and wound down pretty decisively, what do you think that means for American housing, Susan?
Well, there is a short-run impact and a long-run impact, and the word decisive is, of course, key. Mm. If they were wound down instantaneously, let's say we had an edict and they didn't exist tomorrow, then indeed we would have a second crash, which would be very large magnitude and would have the potential to bring on a second Great Recession. So I don't think it's going to happen decisively in terms of timing. Perhaps it will be decisive over the longer run, and that's useful if the word decisive is also meaning plan it. If we plan it with a entity or entities or even a framework that will stand in its stead, that's terrific. The other implication of even the long run, this is now talking long run, of doing away with Fannie Freddie without framework in place is we are at great risk of losing the long-term fixed-rate mortgage, which has been a bulwark for security in the homeownership market prior to this crisis for decades.
So what would that mean if we no longer have a 30-year fixed mortgage available in terms of housing prices, in terms of American finances? I mean, that's been so central to the investment planning, retirement planning, monthly budget planning of so many million American families. What would change, Susan, if that goes away?
Well, yes, let's go back to what may, in retrospect, look like halcyon years, the decades of the 80s, and even prior to that, after World War II, when we built American family wealth, which included a home and retirement, which did not include leveraging and betting the home, as in those crazy years from 2000 to 2006. All of that would be, I believe, somewhat at risk if we went back to a, system essentially we had before the Great Depression, where all holds, no holds barred, do anything, no framework. This would not protect American families.
So, Gretchen, is that where we're headed? What's on the table here? I know there's a number of different, three different options for what may happen with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You're giving kudos to the Obama administration for pushing on this, for acting on it to avoid that kind of economic relapse, collapse again. What are the options out there for where we may go with them, Gretchen?
Well, I think a middle ground is very possible, which goes to some of Susan's points that in the past, you know, we did have requirements where the borrower had to put down a quite significant down payment. And I think that that would get a long way towards reducing the risk in the mortgage itself to the lender, but also it would help the borrower to, you know, have that nest egg. We had a system when there was no money down mortgages and when you could extract equity from your homes. The system was really against the idea of building wealth in your home. It was completely polar opposite to what had been the creation of wealth, you know, for many homeowners going into this period. So the idea that you would require a greater down payment would not only help the lender be more comfortable that the mortgage would not be high risk, because, you know, all the data show that the greater the down payment, the more the borrower has an interest in not defaulting, and so default rates are generally lower. So a greater down payment would reduce the risk of the mortgage to the lender, and it would also enhance the borrower's, financial status.
So, Susan, we'll have comfortable lenders, but what about the American people? Where are they going to live? How long is it going to take them to come up with a 20% down payment? I mean, home prices are still not low in many places. And if they have to do that, what does it do to the market overall while it waits for people to try and, you know, scrape that kind of down payment together?
And before I answer, there's another part of the leverage. I agree that homeowners have to have skin in the game, so to speak. But the other part of the leverage, which was equal and greater, was the leverage in the financial system. So we took maybe 2 or 3% down and then levered that 10, 20, 30 times with a financial system.
That was Wall Street's racket here.
Wall Street, which created the CDOs, CDOs squared, CDOs cubed, and that's what brought down the entire system.
So don't lay it all on the homeowners trying to have a roof over their heads.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the instability of housing prices, which you started the hour with in Seattle, is very much tied to this profusion of mortgage supply, which came from Wall Street, and then the decline, which was sharp and continues. Yes, we have to have standards for the homeowner, but we need standards for Wall Street. And yes, of course, it's going to be harder to become a homeowner, but there are ways of responsible home ownership, sustainable home ownership, which don't involve over leverage either on the part of the homeowner or the system.
But when you see the reductions in home prices that have already been out there, and for some people, you know, that's great. It gives them a way in. For others, it's a tragedy. It's their retirement. For others, it's the very loss of a home. If these two are wound down, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, on the other side of that, could we see the whole price structure drop down another significant notch? I mean, after all, Susan, this is going to happen at around the same time that baby boomers presumably begin to downsize in big numbers. Could we see the whole market chunk down, I don't know, another 30, 40%?
It depends on how we do it. If we do it precipitously, absolutely. If, in fact, we do it in a very considered, slow way, and big if, we have a system in its place that will supply credit in a responsible way that not only homeowners can depend upon, but actually providers of capital to the homeownership can depend upon, then I think we are not at a bottom, unfortunately, but we're near a bottom. At least we could be near a bottom with good policy.
Gretchen, is that alternative financing world out there waiting to be born, ready to, you know, roll into effect? Are there private financiers who are going to want to lend money for a long time at the kind of rates that Americans are accustomed to when it comes to home buying?
Well, I think right now they're holding back. I think that everyone is really waiting to see what Congress decides to do about the housing finance system in this country. Obviously, the administration can't write the legislation that would kill off Fannie and Freddie if, in fact, that is going to happen. So the Congress is really going to have to thrash this out. So I don't think that lenders, are in the mood to kind of take a gamble here that something is going to take Fannie and Freddie's place that is, good or positive. We just don't know what's going to happen. And so in the face of such uncertainty, investors are typically and banks are typically loath to lend.
I got a lot of comments here online. William says, now's a good time to kill these two agencies once and for all. Nick says, prices for houses were ridiculously inflated, should go even lower if they don't. With diminishing wages, there won't be enough people who can afford a house. Katie in Iowa says, how was the rage of 2008 targeted correctly at Wall Street? Corporate greed turned against Fannie and Freddie, government workers, and low-income people. Is that where the hammer ends up coming down, Susan? People trying to, have a house and some stable security in it?
Yes, for now, that's where the hammer is. And we're unfortunately still in a crisis. The crisis has abated. Certainly from last year, from 2009, we're not in a downward spiral, fortunately. But it isn't as though we're in a clearly stable market either. So, and in some markets, we are, in fact, still on a downward trend. In some markets, we're in a recession. The U.S. is officially out of the recession, but we're in a recession in many markets still in the U.S. So we have a long way to go for recovery. In the meantime, we have problems today in terms of stability, getting back to stability.
Tim Geithner saying on Friday that a new system could take maybe 7 years to put in place. It's a long time, but not so long in terms of home ownership. Susan Wachter, Gretchen Morgenson, stand by. We've got lots of listeners and questions, calls here. Wayne in Nashville is on the line. Wayne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
No, hi, Tom.
Hi, Wayne.
My wife and I moved to Tennessee, Savannah, Tennessee, on the Mississippi-Alabama-Tennessee border.
Yep.
From California because she was a teacher and I sold cars and my credit sucked. So we couldn't afford to buy a house.
Yeah.
In 1995 in California.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to Tennessee in 96. We bought a house on 7 acres about 20 miles from, a small touristy city called Savannah, which is kind of a dead-end city. The postal routes go to there, and then they go back to Memphis.
Did you get a good deal?
We got what we thought was a great deal at the time. We paid about $45,000 for that, and then we bought a rental property. But the major manufacturing locally was a Clayton Mobile Home manufacturer. Well, when the economy turned down, in the meantime, the Clayton Mobile Home closed down. My wife's teaching job dried up because there weren't as many people in that county.
Yeah.
We had to move in 2003 to Nashville. We watched our property. If I could get $1,000 an acre for those 7 acres right now, I would be doing really good. It doesn't even matter that we have a house on it. The rental property that they were offering us in 2007, $25,000 for, which has a mobile home on it.
Right.
And in a mobile home area, and we were getting good rent on it. Is worth less than $4,000 or $5,000 now.
Wow.
Now we got a loan to buy our original house.
Yep.
From my father-in-law, a no interest loan that was a high payment, but we paid it back in 10 years.
Yep.
And I'm 60 now.
So you're really up against it.
As a matter of fact, what we are doing is my wife has taken a job in India on a 6-year contract.
In India?
To teach in India, in Chennai, India. And we are moving to India for 6 years so that maybe our property will be worth something when we come back, and we will be able to save enough money cash for her to buy a house. She's about 20 years younger than me.
Unbelievable. Wayne, I've got to stop you right there, but that is an incredible American tale in the year 2011. Wow. Susan Wachter picked that up. I mean, this isn't some high-rolling McMansion flipper. This is a regular American just trying to live and survive and have some place to be.
Wayne's story is the American story for the crisis of this period, including the fact that his wife is going to India to take a job. Yes,
6-year contract.
And it's all about the jobs. The housing market crisis is morphed to a job crisis. That's where the real problems are, and the housing market will not recover until jobs do. And by the way, part of the reason we don't have job growth coming out of this recession is because the construction industry, which is a big part of job generation, is dead in the water.
But Gretchen, back Wayne's story up for a second here, because I mean, you're giving big kudos to Washington for winding down the government agencies that were supporting home ownership. But now he's out there struggling, you know, just to have a place to live. It's not all about people making crazy investments and flipping McMansions. I mean, how does this end up coming down on ordinary Americans who want some stability and some security? They need a job, but they also need a place to live and be able to afford it.
This is a story that has been told to me and that I've written about for about the last 4 years, Tom. I am certainly, my bona fides will tell you I am certainly not pro-Wall Street. And I have written extensively about the really, really dire conditions that the average American has gone through in this crisis as a result of the, you know, exceptional amount of risk-taking and gambling that went on.
But does it just get worse if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac go away?
The problem is, you see, that we have the taxpayers on the hook for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to the tune now of $150 billion, maybe going up to $400 billion. No one really knows. That is unacceptable. It is unacceptable to have quasi-private companies, which these companies were, paying their executives enormous amounts of money, extracting government subsidies and then rewarding their shareholders with part of those subsidies. That is an unacceptable setup. And the fact that these companies took risks to try to generate earnings that they then returned in a form of a higher stock price and excessive bonuses to their executives, only to collapse into the arms of the taxpayers, is wrong.
But you're looking at how Fannie Mae, you're saying it backed up Wall Street and its shenanigans. But what about backing up regular Americans? Is there a way? Would it be under the new, whatever comes out of Timothy Geithner's pipeline here, going to ensure that people can afford somehow to live somewhere?
There are three options, as you know, Tom, that the White House has put out, the Treasury put out. One is to make the system really pretty much government light, I would call it, and that is to rely most heavily on FHA loans, USDA, and Department of Veterans Affairs assistance.
Right.
That is the least government assistance one of these options. And so you are going to have FHA in there to some degree, insuring mortgages for people. It's not that they're saying the government should exit entirely. It's really what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's role should be.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the future of American housing and the winding down of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Susan Wachter is with us from the Wharton School, Gretchen Morgenson from the New York Times. We're going to hear in just a moment from Barry Zegas of the Consumer Federation of America, but we have so many callers waiting here. Paul in Omaha, Nebraska. Thanks for calling, Paul. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I appreciate you taking the call.
Yeah.
Real quickly, one of the points that I would make is that this is a complex problem like a lot of our problems.
No kidding.
And there's multiple elements. One of the issues is the demand side, and I think I'm an older individual. I'm a young baby boomer in his late 50s, and I've watched, you know, my children and their peers get into the housing market. And one of the things that is missing in a lot of this is the old idea of sweat equity. You know, you bought a fixer-upper home, you started in, maybe use an FHA loan, you know, and built up your equity, you know, through learning how to take care of a home, how to remodel, how to, you know, paint and so forth. And then you built your way up. You know, that's an outmoded way of home ownership these days. We see a lot of young people jumping in our neck of the woods out here in the Midwest. You know, you can buy a pretty nice home for, you know, $200,000,
right,
$150,000. And you see a lot of these young people, you know, fresh out of college, young families, jumping into homes that are $150,000, $200,000 homes, or sometimes higher.
And not kind of paying their dues, building that equity. It's a great question, Paul, because, I mean, another angle of it is, will we build equity? You know, building equity was one thing when home prices were going up and up. It didn't take too long to do it. Susan Wachter, how do you respond to that view? First of all, you know, where do we go with the whole idea of starter homes? If we're headed into this future, you know, are people's expectations going to have to come down? Or are they greater because no one's going to pay the boomers a whole lot for those big old homes and the next generation will be able to step right into them? What about getting in and building equity, Susan?
Expectations is key, and Tom is right on. This would be great to get back to sweat equity and building equity over time. But part of the problem, a key problem, is this incredible volatility in house prices, this 30% up and 30% down.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like a good prospect to be plugging away at your efforts, putting in and building investment value in your home if it can be subject to these swings. That's a problem. These ups and downs are a systemic problem that we have to get a handle on. And indeed, if we don't, then we are absolutely moving to a system of rentership. And that has its downsides as well, because we're not talking about it right now, but rents are going up. And people can be priced out of a rental market as well over time. That's the good thing of a home ownership, sustainable home ownership, when it works,
right,
is that you're not priced out over time. Of course, that doesn't mean taking on excess leverage and betting your house.
Gretchen, do you see a stable home ownership, you know, slow but steady equity building on the other side of a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac reform? Is that out there?
I think it is out there. I think that we have to get to, as Susan points out, the stability of pricing. I mean, as my colleague David Streitfeld reported, we're still in a huge state of flux in many places. I think that we're finding the bottom in pricing in some of the places that took the hardest hits, like Las Vegas and Florida. And we will find the bottom in these other places. At that point in time, I don't think that we will continue to have these, you know, huge downward moves, and people can start to feel a little bit more comfortable about, you know, investing and not seeing their investment go down the drain.
Paul in Omaha, thanks for your call. Let's get another from South Londonderry, Vermont. Jerry. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just a point on this Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This all started with Jimmy Carter's administration, and every president after that pushed, you know, the home ownership idea. The first hint of the problem was in 1989 with the savings and loan meltdown. And we didn't learn from that.
And what about now? Is it a good idea to wind them down then, Jerry, or not?
Yes. Yes, I believe it is.
Why? What do you see coming?
Because of mismanagement. These people have committed fraud and everything else, and nobody's going to jail. These people deserve to go to jail for mismanagement. They took the people's trust and used it against them.
But where do you stop putting people in jail? I mean, there's the people who ran them, but there's Wall Street that fed off them.
Oh yeah. No, they're all at fault. But what I think is what should be done is they got to wind them down very carefully. It'd be a good idea to take these foreclosures, and there are a lot of people buying them up for, you know, starter homes, and also for rentals. Okay, there's a lot of investment out there that are taking these properties and turning them into rental properties.
Little by little, though, there too, as Susan points out, you don't know where that story ends up once you get into it. I appreciate your call, Jerry. I want to bring Barry Zegas in here right now from Washington, Director of Housing Policy for the Consumer Federation of America. He's a former senior vice president at Fannie Mae. Until 2006, he led community lending initiatives there. Barry, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, thanks for having me. Susan, Gretchen, good to be with you.
What do you see in the winding down of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac? Is that good?
Well, I think a couple of key points. One is it's important to separate the question of what we do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two companies as they currently exist, and as you've heard earlier in your show, what replaces them and what vision we have for providing stable, long-term, affordable financing for home ownership for working and middle-class Americans. Putting aside Fannie and Freddie per se, we've got to focus on what the objectives of government policy and housing ought to be. And we feel very strongly that preservation of access to long-term fixed-rate financing has to be a key priority. And as the administration has acknowledged in its papers and as the lending industry has acknowledged in their proposals, there's very little expectation that consumers can expect that outcome unless there is a form of federal support through a guarantee of some kind to help assure investors that making these long-term investments is a sensible decision for them.
But if you have that, aren't we right back in the risk spot that we were in before that took us to the cliff and over it with Fannie Mae?
Well, that's a great question, and it's important to remember that when people say they want to see a fully private home mortgage sector, the fact of the matter is America hasn't seen a fully private home mortgage sector since 1934.
Yeah, it's a long time.
When we had a fully private home mortgage sector, it was housing for the wealthy with short-term loans that had to be paid off every 5 years, often with interest only, with extremely high down payments. And even in spite of that conservative approach, it's one of the key drivers that led to the Great Depression in the 1930s.
Imagine that we go back there, because we just had a panic and a crash going the other way. But if we go to a system like that again, Barry, what would the American housing market look like?
The American housing market would look much more stratified, far more renters, far fewer homeowners, and homeowners who could get into a home would face much more uncertainty about the payments they would have to make on their mortgages, the certainty of being able to stay in their home, and it would lead to much greater instability, I think, than the system we had in place from 1934 and 38 when Fannie Mae was first founded, right up until Wall Street banks and hedge funds were allowed to run wild by taking investors' money and putting it into mortgages that were unsafe, unsound, and often predatory with respect to the terms that they were offering consumers.
If I may
make a real clear distinction here about what caused this crisis, and it was not, you know, 50 years of American housing policy supporting long-term fixed-rate financing for middle-income Americans. It was Wall Street, in an unregulated environment, rushing to find ways to earn fees by increasing volume and giving loans in an irresponsible way, and regulators standing by and not doing anything.
Gretchen, can we have the kind of support and guarantees for housing and home finance that Barry's talking about without ending back, you know, right up where we were in 2008?
A couple of problems with the guarantees, and that one is, how do you price the guarantee? We obviously, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, we did not price the guarantees appropriately, and that's why we ended up with the taxpayer on the hook for whatever the ultimate outcome in the hundreds of billions is. We don't know that number yet. So pricing the guarantee is a conundrum and a difficult thing to do. But second of all is the creation of a whole raft of too-big-to-fail institutions. If you have situations where you have credit guarantee companies set up to guarantee mortgages, it's almost a given, or it's implicit. We've bailed out so many entities in this crisis that these two would be sort of a version of a government-sponsored enterprise and would not be allowed to fail. And so my fear is that we would be creating additional too-big-to-fail institutions. I believe that there is private money on the sidelines looking for good investment in solid, sound mortgages because of what the interest rate would be on those mortgages versus what an investor is getting on, say, a treasury, for example.
But let me ask you, because Barry's presenting sort of the view that we're sort of shooting the ordinary citizen here to save the overall system. He says, don't do that. Just get in there and really regulate instead. What about that?
Well, how well did the regulators do their job the last time around?
Not too well, not too
I
well.
I would say not too well. And so what is there to say that they will do it well the next time?
Yeah, if I may...
Sandra, Susan,
here,
excuse me, yes.
Missing the last time for the regulators, and I might say for Wall Street too, was an ability to track actually what was happening. Many people were thinking there was a bubble, obviously, and that mm-hmm. we were at risk because there's too much leverage. But knowing the actual amount of leverage that was out there was very difficult. And knowing the pricing of that leverage, the fact that, you know, Gretchen's quite right, did a very poor job of pricing at Fannie Freddie, but the private sector also did an extremely poor job. The pricing of credit, the cost of a loan, the rate on a loan coming out of the private sector decreased over this period. Wall Street asked for less of return as these loans were being pushed. They just were betting the house themselves, unfortunately, the houses of Americans.
Barry, what do you say?
Tom, if I could jump in also.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Gretchen makes some very excellent points. And what I would say is that as we move forward, it's important to distinguish the what went wrong from what happened to cause it to go so wrong. So she's raised a couple of very important points.
She said we didn't regulate well then. We won't do it next time. We don't have any choice but to close down that path.
Well, I would actually beg to differ on that. The institutions that drove the economy over the cliff were not being regulated at all. Many of them were completely outside of the regulatory framework, and that was one of the big problems. She is right that regulators in this crisis also failed to exercise their appropriate prudential responsibilities when plenty of people were telling them that the housing market had gotten way beyond the parameters that were safe and sound. And that is a complete regulatory failure. Now, if we think that the private sector, left to its own devices, will act more responsibly than a regulatory structure that is reinforced and learns from this set of mistakes, then Gretchen and I do have a disagreement. Yep. I believe that it's possible to create a regulatory framework that functions correctly and appropriately. The Dodd-Frank legislation that passed the Congress and President signed into law last year actually creates a much smaller box for the kind of mortgage lending that can take place at the interaction between consumers and their lenders. That's an important first step. The second step has to be to learn from the problems that emerged out of the GSE, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac experience. Regulators should set the capital, not Congress. There should be a guarantee only of the securities that they issue, not of the entities. And that will go a long way to resolving two of the big drivers that helped make this problem so great.
A lot on the line as this gets debated. Let me get a call here from Sandra in Boston. Sandra, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that my husband and I were renters for over 20 years.
Yeah.
And we were fortunate enough to walk into Eastern Bank in here in Boston, and be introduced to the soft second mortgage program, and we bought a two-family. And we also had to take a home buying, first-time home buying class. We took that class through MAHA here in Boston.
How's it all working out for you, Sandra? Are you happier as a homeowner?
Well.
Yeah.
Yes. And I just wanted to say that I really believe that these types of educational programs for home buyers are just crucial, and, you know, programs like MAHA and first-time home buying programs through the city of Boston, I think, are very, very important for homeowners. And I think if there were more people that took these classes, I don't think a lot of this would happen.
Sandra, I appreciate your call. Susan,
yes.
You're listening to all this.
Sandra's right on, and I'm glad she called. Thank you. The data, the information is out there that says that good counseling, good program support for low-income homeownership actually can work. And key here is not taking on too much leverage, not buying more than you can afford.
There's going to be a hell of a debate in the coming weeks and months over what to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Where do you come down, Susan, in terms of how much guarantee should remain in the system for lenders? And
let's be clear. You know, if we do nothing, what will happen is we will have four major banks who will be providing most of the mortgages, and they are too big to fail. And we do have deposit insurance, which we, the taxpayer, supports. So there is a guarantee, even if there isn't a guarantee.
You mean even if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac go away, there's still a guarantee?
There is. So that's why it seems to me we must have clarity and standards so that we, the people, we investors, we regulators can track what's going on in the market. And when there begins to be a leverage problem and when there begins to be products that cannot be repaid, it's out there. It's known. It's tracked. And in fact, we put standards in place so that we can track this and standards in place so that we don't have the excesses, the predatory lending of the
product. Gretchen, maybe there's no choice there, Gretchen, but good regulation, the way Susan puts it. If there's, you know, we're on the hook no matter what, if it's just four big banks and they're too big to fail.
Listen, I am all for good regulation. I think the regulatory failure was inexcusable. I mean, there is chapter and verse on the warnings that were given and provided to the regulators. The regulators at the SEC knew about the leverage in the brokerage industry and did nothing about it. In fact, they allowed it to increase. So, you know, I just look at that and say, gosh, how are we going to restructure regulators so that they actually do their jobs and are not captured by the industries they oversee?
Barry, we've just got half a minute here. Are we going to recognize the American housing market 10 years from now?
I think that will depend on the actions Congress takes in the next few years. We are in danger of going back to a place where only the wealthy can afford to buy a home with any security, and where a long, decades-long commitment by the federal government to support affordable home ownership for working people will be in jeopardy. And that will have serious implications as we look at an increasingly diverse and growing population in the next 10 to 20 years.
Well, eyes wide open, everybody. No one wants to go back to panic and crash and bailout. Future has a lot of question marks as well. Grateful to the three of you for helping us look ahead. Barry Zegas with the Consumer Federation of America. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome, Tom.
Susan Wachter at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Thanks as always, Susan.
Pleasure.
And Gretchen Morgenson with the New York Times. Wonderful to have you with us. Thank you very much, Gretchen.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.